Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time for our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us this week is Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Hi, great to be here.
Also with us, Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Kathy Kandisky. Happy Monday, Kathy.
Happy Monday.
And Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Welcome back, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
Voters gave the zoo, I think this was in a headline somewhere, a roaring no on primary day. It came out 70-30, so there's a 40 percentage points between the yays and the nays. Joe Engels, did you think it would be that bad?
No, actually, I thought it would be close, at least close. And I, part of me even thought the zoo would win because, I mean, people seem to love the zoo. There's a widespread love for the zoo, and it's never really been questioned before. But this ask was pretty big compared to past, past levies. And also, and it was permanent. And I think the other thing is that people are at the point where they love the zoo, but they don't necessarily want to pay for it anymore. And, you look at the different changes over the past two decades in Franklin County and Columbus. Used to be you could get to the zoo pretty much from anywhere in about a 20-minute drive, at most. And now, if you live over by Easton and you try to go to the zoo, that's a project because, there's just really no quick way to get anywhere around Central Ohio anymore. The infrastructure in Central Ohio has not kept pace with the growth. And therefore, you have transportation issues. A lot of people, if you don't have a car and you want to go to the zoo, you're kind of out of luck because there's really no way to get there. So there's all these things that have contributed to people just really not feeling the zoo as part of their life. They're glad that the zoo's there, but they just don't want to pay for it because they don't think that's what they should be doing.
Well, I think that part of it, there was a lot of talk about why only Franklin County voters were being asked to support the zoo when the zoo is physically located in Delaware County and, of course, serves people and is enjoyed by folks.
By everyone.
In several counties around. That was an issue that I heard after the fact. But I have to say, like Joe, I did think it was going to pass because same reason you said, I think that people love the zoo. I love the zoo, and it seems like Franklin County voters are pretty supportive. But the other thing is, I think, although the economy's improved and unemployment's lower, wages are not keeping up with inflation. And I think, people are maybe getting a small, if any, pay raise, but their health care is going up higher, their utility bills are going up higher, all their expenses are going up, and their salaries and earnings aren't keeping pace. And I think people are not necessarily in a position to be as generous as they once were. And I think that was another factor with this levy.
Well, generous as they once were is one thing. Do you think if a renewal of the current $18 million levy were to go on the ballot that people would be more supportive of it versus the increase that
Absolutely.
They were asking for?
I mean, a renewal, yeah. I mean, then you just have to hammer
There's
the message.
There's no new money.
This isn't anything new. This is what you've been doing all along. And okay, we're doing this now. We'll continue to do it. Yeah, I think a renewal would have a lot better success. A lot more success, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think another factor in the levy was this idea of a downtown expansion. A lot of people weren't sure exactly what that would look like and whether it was something that taxpayers should be funding. Over and over again, I heard people that I was talking to saying, I support the zoo, I love the zoo, but, this downtown expansion, if it's going to serve to be a facility for business functions and others and school functions, maybe like those groups should get together and figure out a way to fund it rather than all of the taxpayers of Franklin County.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking about the zoo levy, how it failed miserably last week on the primary ballot. We'll be talking about some other primary issues. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I thought one of the explanations for the huge number of voters that or percentage of voters that opposed the levy was that there was so many things to not like or like about the right. proposal. There was the downtown, there was the amount, the doubling of the rate, the permanence of it, the amount, the sheer amount of it, the downtown satellite operation that was proposed, and all the other stuff. A lot of people think, well, the zoo works. Why do we need to add more to it? But do you think that could be some explanation for why so many people who might have supported it, opposed it?
Sure. I think that's definitely a part of it. But I think even if you go back for a renewal now, it's going to be tougher than it was before. Because now all these reasons that have been brought up, you never heard until this levy, we didn't hear people saying, oh, Delaware County ought to pay for the zoo because it's in their backyard. That's a new thing on this
levy. That is new.
And, you know, that's not going to change because the zoo's not going to move. But I would like to point out that zoo was there, you know, 30 years before, and people didn't have a problem with it being in Delaware County's backyard until this levy. So, you know, and whether Delaware County should pay for part of it or something like that, but they do pay some right now. With we've established that with the
services
and.
Right.
And the fact that it's a huge land mass and nonprofit, so there's that loss of, you know, so there is, Delaware County does contribute some. Now, whether, you know, what I could see, Anne, you know, coming back in the next few years is some sort of joint proposal with Delaware County. And I'm just saying this from
right
what
now,
I
it's
read
against
in the paper.
State law. Yeah. They would have to change state law
they
to
would.
Do a
they
multi-county
would.
Tax.
Right. If we were going to fund the zoo like Franklin County, they would have to change state law to do that. But I think there are a lot of problems in central Ohio that need to be addressed. The zoo is one of them. There's also the transportation problem. There are also problems with services. Delaware County is a growing county. And if you look at the way some of the services are provided, it's kind of haphazard, actually, and the infrastructure's not there for certain things.
So, in other words, maybe Delaware County voters wouldn't be as... They have other issues to deal with as well, wouldn't necessarily glom onto a zoo levy.
I don't think they would, unless there was economic development that was going to come about to Delaware County because of it. You know, if you were looking at that factor, if Delaware County could see a motherload of economic development coming out of it for some reason, and you were combining it with other issues, you know, such as transportation or services or something like that, that might make a difference.
And I think that voters also need to hear from the supporters of the levy, who need to acknowledge that they totally misjudged the electorate on this one. I think they have to really, they have to come, you know, to terms with the electorate and then make another pitch, because they need to shake this. They need to shake off this loss if they're going to be successful. And to do that, you're going to need to, you know, basically say, you know, we heard you. We're going to go back. We're going to relook. We're going to, you know, modify our plan. And then they're going to have to, as Joe mentioned, get involved with stakeholder groups and really make sure everybody's at the table. I heard from some, and I didn't cover the levy directly, but I heard from some people that there was kind of a notion amongst some voters that this was kind of like a downtown, you know, bosses deal, that they put this together. They thought this was good for the community, and some people felt it was more, you know, kind of put upon them, and they need to be engaged in the discussion.
Yep. Larry and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Larry.
Hello. I just wanted to remind you folks that only 16% of the electorate, the eligible electorate, voted in this election. And it's pretty apparent to me that the anti-tax people got their people out better than the people that were pro-zoo. So, and of course, you know, we don't live all that far from the zoo, but we can't vote on the issue. I just wanted to point that out to you.
Yeah, it's a good point. That's why I kind of changed my tune when I said a large number. It wasn't a large number of voters. It was a large percentage of those who voted. And Larry, thanks a lot for that call.
You do kind of wonder, though, what the spread would be in a November election.
You do. They didn't put it on the primary ballot by accident, though.
No.
Yeah, that was strange to me. Why would you put the zoo, which is a popular place, why would you put it on the May ballot? That was kind of
somehow figuring
place.
That people who tend to support the zoo also tend to vote in primary elections.
Well, in the primary election, you have people who tend to always vote, right, and who tend to identify with a party or, you know, want to support a party candidate. So if you think about that group of voters, they're more predictable. And I could see that. But again, because it's such a small group that's already going to the polls, it's much easier to sway it.
Alex in Grandview, you're on the air. You voted for the zoo levy.
I did. My question is related to what you were just talking about. You know, I mean, basically, I'm just baffled by the idea that it would be a good idea to put this levy onto a ballot where you know that most of the people who are voting are part of a political movement whose name is an acronym for Taxed Enough Already.
Well, why do you say that you know that the majority of the voters are going to be from an anti-tax point of view?
Well, I mean, in general, people who vote in off-year elections, people who vote in primary elections, tend to be older, whiter, more likely to be college educated, but mm-hmm. not necessarily like graduate education. These are all things that are basically like check marks in the like average Tea Party voter demographic.
Okay, I see what you mean. There was a Democratic primary though on the ballot. Mm-hmm. The governor,
well, governor and I voted in that, mm-hmm. but you know, I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. when you talk about like Democratic voters, they tend to be ones who can't necessarily get time off mm-hmm. On Tuesday.
When would you propose putting out if you were working with supporters?
I mean, I would have shot certainly for the November election, and for something large like this that actually involves raising taxes, I probably would have tried not to do it in an off year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
Alex, thanks a lot for your call.
All right. Thanks
Take
for your
care.
Time.
You bet. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just wondering why Franklin County, who pays for this, doesn't get a discount. Franklin County voters don't get a discount at the zoo.
Well, they do a couple days a week, or at least one day a week, Kathy?
I don't know. My zoo days, I mean, I used to go a lot more when I had little kids. I don't go so much.
I bought a pass every year, and I don't get any kind of discount on that.
You don't get a discount?
Not uh-huh. for living in Franklin County that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. They might consider that since that was an issue that was brought up. That's a really good point.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. Take care.
I think there is one day a week that Franklin County residents
can go. That's not the same. Like in Florida, you know, Florida residents can go to Disney at a big discount.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
I didn't know
any
that.
Day. Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of museums are that
there?
Way, too. You know, they have, if you're a resident
friends.
Of the city or the county or the state, even, you get a reduced rate.
That's not a bad
Wednesday
idea.
Wednesday is free for Franklin County, but there is no discount on memberships.
Oh, okay.
So
if you go on Wednesday.
Yeah. Wednesday, which is kind of limiting to a lot of people. I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
But be that as it may, my panel of esteemed colleagues, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch, Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and I will return in just a moment. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher, and with me in the studio, our weekly reporter roundtable, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We're turning our sights now to the gubernatorial race. It was no surprise that Democrat Ed Fitzgerald emerged the victor in the gubernatorial primary, Democratic gubernatorial primary. He now moves on to the general election race against incumbent Republican John Kasich. Did the primary tell us anything useful about Ed Fitzgerald? Jackie Borchardt?
Well, I think that there was some worry that maybe Larry Ely was his opponent in the Democratic primary. He was from Dayton, a community activist, and he raised enough collection of signatures to make it on the ballot, but beyond that point, didn't do much in the way of campaigning or fundraising. So it was pretty clear that Fitzgerald was going to be the victor on primary day. But Fitzgerald won 83% of the vote, which I think is pretty good and probably the best that could have resulted from that. You know, if Larry Ely had received, you know, upwards of 20-25% of the vote, then I think that would show that the Fitzgerald campaign has a problem with voters knowing who he is and voting for him. So other than that, I mean, you know, it was a low turnout, lower than in 2010 even. So I don't know if we can really, you know, read too much into the gubernatorial primary. I think certainly in the legislative races across the state, they're a little bit more interesting. We had one in Northeast Ohio that was pretty close with incumbent Democrat John Barnes Jr. and Jill Miller-Zeiman, and Barnes edged her out, but it was very close. And then Southwest Ohio, we saw a couple seats turn over in Republican primaries, and then one in the Democratic Senate seat.
We know that the Tea Party is trying to make inroads through legislative primaries, but not necessarily in the Democratic races. What was special about the Barnhart and Zeiman race?
Representative Barnes has voted with Republicans on a number of measures in the last couple of years. His budget, Governor Kasich's budget, for example, which, you know, is kind of a big no-no if you're in the minor party and every day saying how bad this budget is and then to vote against your party. The Ohio Democratic Party made a point not to endorse Representative Barnes. And so, you know, to be an incumbent and not be endorsed by your own state party, that's a pretty bad sign.
How close was it?
You know, I can't remember the official final count, but it was, when I was watching it, it was between, you know, it was almost 50-50. It was the closest primary I'd seen in a while. And then I think at the end, you know, Barnes kind of pulled ahead a little bit more in the as far as counting things go. But I think Southwest Ohio is really interesting because that's where you actually saw some Tea Party influence play out, because really out of, I don't know, Joe, there were what, like two dozen or so races where the Tea Party said,
26, I believe,
Tea Party officials said, you know, we have an endorsed candidate. Our super PAC has endorsed these people. And they didn't win. And at least in Northeast Ohio, they didn't win at all. So
yeah. I think there were five House seats that actually were won that flipped. And, you know, what was interesting is Tom Zawistowski, one of the Tea Party leaders in
Portage
Ohio.
County.
Yeah, he's out of Portage County. And, you know, I talked with him after the election, and he said, this is a victory for the Tea Party. And I'm sitting there going, okay, 26 candidates, how's this a victory? And he says, well, you know, we held our own and we added one in the House. And, you know, for us to be a formidable, you know, force here, you know, it's a victory for us. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, he thinks that just, you know, not winning is not necessarily, you know, winning is not the thing for him. It's being in there and being able to shift.
Changing the conversation a little bit?
Changing the conversation. But I don't know how much change in the conversation there's going to be when the party-endorsed candidates are winning by and large in most all of these races.
Well, and we're coming up on 5 years of kind of the birth of the Tea Party. And to say 5 years later that winning is changing one seat, I don't know. You'd think it would be stronger by then. I think it shows that as a movement, they're not winning, and that they either need some sort of refocus or need to, you know, be reabsorbed in the Republican Party, because Republicans, the establishment, is saying, well, yeah, you know, we'll take them. they're Republican voters. You know, they may be against us in the primary, but in November, you know, my guess is most of them will be voting for John Kasich.
That's it.
I know executive committee, Republican state executive committee slots were opened up this primary. And I don't know whether, I know there was a Tea Party candidate going after one of those committee positions. it's very under the radar. Most people don't know who they are. They don't care. It's Republican Party business. But
well, the Tea Party's candidates have had a lot of success early. This is how they kind of got started, was on those central committees, on school boards, mm-hmm. local, you know, local government entity, you know, school boards, things like that. And that's kind of where, you know, they've got their foothold.
Right.
And it seems like this election, they haven't progressed. There wasn't much progress made this election on the state level.
And so do you think they changed the conversation very much? They got anybody talking about things that maybe they had been 5 years ago when they first emerged? I think Jackie made a good point. But now is it?
I think now, you know, what I read out of this is that the mainline Republican Party is distancing itself from the Tea Party.
That's right.
We saw the Tea Party in the last election come up with some pretty conservative ideas and ideas that were not widely embraced in the general election. And I think, you know, there's a certain thrust in the Republican Party to want the electable candidate in November. And they see, you know, that candidate as being more moderate, more down the middle. And so they don't want some of these Tea Party people in there, you know, rattling chains, saying things that are going to make the candidates unelectable. And, you know, you see more of a, if you look at this ballot, you see more of a thrust by the Republican Party to go with more moderate candidates to try to get to that middle.
Do you think there's going to be something of a showdown when it comes to the Republican, whoever is nominated to run for president from the Republican Party?
No.
Okay. You think it'll be the same?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that we haven't mentioned is money has a huge control
oh, yeah.
in this process.
Money.
Yeah.
Money and, in politics.
I think, you know, you might have a lot of Tea Party folks who are not happy with a Republican candidate. But let's face it, unless there's a lot of money invested to get their message out there and get people kind of rattled and thinking about what they're saying, you know, it's not going to matter because there's going to be the money behind the candidates that we know will be there.
Well, I think one of my colleagues had a story recently that is it Chris Littleton, who was heavily involved mm-hmm. in the Tea Party here in Ohio, lived in Cincinnati,
right.
packed up his family and moved to Tennessee because he didn't see Ohio as a place where they could have much of an impact anymore.
Right.
I would love to sit down and talk to him and find out exactly what he's seeing, you know, how he's reading the tea leaves, because I think it's fascinating that he would move to try and, you know, take his...
Well, one thing Ohio has a lot of is big cities, urban areas, yeah. urban mm-hmm. centers. They, you know, it's not like one big city in the whole state,
no.
or even like a Michigan yeah. where you have a Detroit and a Grand Rapids, and that's about it
mm-hmm.
now.
I can't compare us to Michigan.
We cannot.
Oh, good grief.
One of those. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about state government, politics, you name it, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Did you, do you consider yourself, do you identify with the Tea Party movement in Ohio? What do you make of it? Do you think... the Tea Party has a chance here, or are you like Chris Littleton, who's heading to Nashville or some such place?
Not that it's not a fun place to go.
It's a very fun place to live, but I don't think Nashville's where you're going to find a lot of your Tea Party voters either. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we didn't learn anything particular about Ed Fitzgerald, though, this election. He didn't really stand out. We learned a lot about, on the other hand, John Kasich. He aired a very big and splashy and incrementally large ad all the way through the NHL playoffs between Pittsburgh and the Blue Jackets. Did any of you guys catch those commercials?
Oh, yeah.
You know, did you learn anything?
Hard not to if you were watching any of those games.
You know, yeah, I think the interesting thing is, though, that they were defining, those ads were meant to define John Kasich, a governor who's been in office, and everyone should know. All these definition points should be out there. You shouldn't have to tell
So they must have
people.
Something telling them that maybe people don't know him as well as they think they ought.
You know, I think after Kasich came into office, one of the first things he did was take on Senate Bill 5,
right,
take on the unions, and try and limit collective bargaining and the other provisions with that. And I think that kind of gave him a bad rap. And that's what a lot of people think of, a lot of voters who were invested in that issue, who cared about that issue. And of course, that was that went on the ballot and went down. It was repealed. The law was repealed. So I think he's trying to remind voters, hey, that's not what I'm all about. I also have...
Even if it defined my first 2 years in office.
Right. I think he wants to remind voters about his upbringing, you know, about, you know, they're, like you said, they're largely biographical. And I, the one that I heard also reminds voters that he has done things for the poor, which he has in office, mm-hmm. of course, Medicaid expansion.
Which means the Koch brothers will never come... whistling down the road with any money for him.
So I think he's trying to remind voters of who he is, really who he is. You know, it really, I mean, I'm being a little facetious there, mm-hmm. but really who he is, and try and shed any of those negative, any negative impact thoughts folks might have about him from some of those tougher battles early on.
Right, right. You know, he's got... What, $8.5 million now in the bank? I don't think he's going to need Koch brother money. But.
Well, and it gets back to money. I mean, Fitzgerald's the one that should be on the air
right.
doing some nice bio spots, but that's you haven't seen those.
But it's so early. I mean, really, I mean, I know we're covering it and the politics started 6 months ago. Or,
it doesn't really matter yet to most people.
Yeah, but don't you think once one starts, you almost have to respond, even though it's not an attack ad or anything
Fitzgerald
did
have a radio ad. He did release a radio ad, but I mean, it's not the same as having a sharp
note.
Television ad in your face while you're
watching the playoffs.
Right. And I think in that ad too, it wasn't, 100% pro Fitzgerald either. It had to first talk about Kasich and then say, you know, and here's your other choice.
You know, the one thing I notice about Ed Fitzgerald is it seems like the message is not honed clearly. You look at they're all over the place as far as issues. The Democrats have a lot of issues on the table. And it really, I mean, you really need to drill home issues that, you know, you need to have an issue that's synonymous with Ed Fitzgerald and something that people can hang their hat on. When you have too many things that people just get confused.
As we found with the zoo and these mm-hmm. Columbus City mm-hmm. Schools levies. Mm-hmm. too many things gives too many people a reason. Too many people a reason to
vote
ignore
no
you or to
yeah.
vote no.
Yeah, right. But you know, I think Senate Bill 5. I mean, that's why we're seeing a lot of this. You know, the teachers were upset, the firefighters, the police officers, everyone who loved them. Those were the people who came out and voted Senate Bill 5 down. And you know, now you've got these ads coming out. They're trying to make you forget Senate Bill 5. They're trying to make you focus on some other things you might like in these ads. And that's the whole strategy to Governor Kasich's reelection, is to make people forget. So, or make them at least, you know,
forget who
at
I
least
am.
Forget enough to say yes at the ballot, you know?
Maybe he shouldn't even be in his own ad.
Forget the man behind the curtain. Well, his mid-biennium budget includes a provision that is going to make a lot of people upset, apparently. This is a different provision. It allows gambling winnings to be seized to pay overdue child support. Kathy, is that another example of him reaching out to, you know, well, children and helping children? That's a big part of what he does, and the least among us, sort of a theme to his candidacy.
Yeah. Well, this, you know, Ohio recently legalized, we just voted to have casinos. Now we have casinos. I think there's 5 casinos in Ohio. Other states that have casinos have provisions like this. Ohio would not be the first. It's pretty typical. If you win an amount at a casino or a racino, in an amount that has to be reported to the IRS for tax purposes, you will automatically be checked. The casino will do a cross check to see if there's a back child support order on you. And if there is, say you win $5,000, you know, whatever, your taxes get taken out of that. And then if there's any outstanding child support, that would get taken out of that. The state, based on the experience of other states, the state thinks it could collect up to $1 million or more a year for children. It's hard to argue against this kind of a thing because the reality is these are people that haven't paid their child support. They're not taking care of their kids. So it's kind of hard to argue against it. The state also has a goal to try and increase support collections. Right now, last year, Ohio collected about $1.3 billion in child support, which was only 68% of what was owed. So that's a lot of money out there and a lot of kids that aren't getting support from their one parent or the other. So it's going to be kind of tough to argue against it. But certainly I kind of wonder if I just won big at the craps table and I go to cash, no matter, you know, if you're deadbeat mom or dad, you go and cash in for your winnings and find out you're not taking anything home because you didn't pay your child support. I'm sure securities are equipped to deal with people like that, but it could be interesting.
But, you know, this happens a lot. I mean, if you're behind in your taxes, for example, they can take your money, you know, and different things. So I don't think in the scheme of the political nature that this is going to make any difference.
Right.
This is not going to be a big thing. It's going to come down to how people feel in November and the ads and the messages that resonate then. And if people feel like they're better off than they were 4 years ago and they feel like they're, you know, things are going in the right direction, I think they're going to vote for Governor Kasich.
Remember when he was speaking to the Ohio EPA staff early on in his, Ohio EPA, and he started dissing the state highway patrol officer who pulled him over on the highway, called him an idiot several times or something like that. This is, we're talking about John Kasich now.
When he got pulled over.
He got pulled over for speeding, something,
yeah.
And anyways, he was criticizing how the officer handled the event later on, some years later, at this EPA event where he's speaking to Ohio EPA employees. And someone, of course, in this age of smartphones, caught it on their phone and it went all over the place, went viral. Mm-hmm. Everybody's heard it. I'm sure everybody wrote about it. Mm-hmm. What about something like that? Everyone at the time said, oh, in 4 years, this is going to come out. But Joe Ingles, you're shaking your head. You don't think it will.
It's not going to matter. Because I remember before the election between John Kasich and Ted Strickland, there was a huge article in the other paper when it used
about
to exist.
About his temperament.
Yeah, and it basically outlined all these situations where now Governor Kasich didn't look so good at the time, you know, with waiters talking, you know, speaking poorly of him, and people who had worked with him were speaking poorly of him. It was just, you know, basically
this isn't a popularity contest, people.
Yeah, and I think it was 3 or 4 pages just lambasting him for the way he had treated other people, and especially people who weren't of his stature in some way. And I don't think that made a hill of beans difference to voters, or it didn't seem like it did, because it didn't really resonate. You didn't hear that in polling afterwards. There was nothing that showed that was a big issue. So
the big
issues
you hit on earlier is they're going to be in unemployment rate, jobs, how people feel about where they're at right now.
If it was a close race, things like that might matter, but at this, well, actually, it is.
It'll
a close
be closer
race
than
right
you think it'll when be, it yeah. gets down to it. It'll be closer than you think, but the, you know, Kasich. I mean, something bad would have to happen really to kind of upset his reelection, and that I guess is up to him.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to see, if we were going to see right to work on the ballot this fall, I think that would make this a much closer, you know, much more in-your-face kind of race. But for a lot of people, you know, they're not going to see that on the ballot. This is going to come down to how you feel. So,
okay. We will return to more conversation about state government politics, what's going on in the news, with our State House Reporters Roundtable. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. If you have a question or comment you want to add to the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Before we move on, Kathy, just another issue that's, I think it's in the biennium you know, the new budget bill, for lack
off your budget.
Off your budget. That's good. Some mental health organizations are worried that lawmakers want to take funds for mental illness treatment to pay for addiction services. It's kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul in a way. Kathy Kandisky, what does it mean to the average mental health consumer?
Well, the problem is that it's complicated. But generally speaking, the budget had some money in it. The state gave mental health some money, and Kasich wanted to earmark it for, and he did earmark it for, things that Medicaid doesn't pay, like housing for people in need of mental health and addiction services. And the reason non-Medicaid services is important is because the governor expanded Medicaid. So a lot of mentally ill folks in need of treatment now are on Medicaid. So their care is going to be paid that way. So the money was supposed to pay for things that weren't covered under
Medicaid.
That
helps with stability and that sort of thing.
Yes, that helps them get better in addition to the treatment and medications and whatever else. What the House did, the House is very concerned about opiate addiction in Ohio. And so they took that money and they earmarked it for treatment for people that are addicted to opiates. And that upset the mental health community. And it's kind of an odd thing because mental health and addiction services are one in terms of their one state department. Mm-hmm. They're treated, you know, at the county level, they're often treated as one and, you know, served together. And now they've taken money that was to serve both constituencies and put it towards the drug side, the drug addiction side. And that has gotten the mental health folks upset. But in all fairness, they don't think it's not a good thing to fund drug addiction.
Right.
They just think cough up a little more money and do both. Don't take money from one to do the other. Just pay for both. And that's kind of where that's at. And we'll see what the Senate's going to do with it. The governor's office is asking the Senate to basically erase what the House did, go back to his original proposal. And I should point out that these drug addiction services were in separate bills previously that the House passed that have lingered in the Senate. And I think the House was upset. Some members of the House were upset that the Senate had not acted on those bills. And so they stuck the same. They basically tucked the bills into the governor's off your budget, hoping to kind of get it through that way. So we'll see what happens with it. Maybe the separate bills, maybe the Senate will move on the separate bills and revert. That would be the compromise to me, is the Senate just moves on the separate bills and then reverts to the governor's budget.
Now, just so listeners are completely aware, it used to be the budget bill came out every couple years, and there might
every
be a budget
two.
Every 2 years, and it might be there might be what we used to call a budget correction bill that would just be adjusting numbers and so forth based on what actual revenues were and that sort of thing.
Correct.
This is different. This is an off-year budget, really. It's a whole.
They call it a mid-biennium review,
which we don't ever want to say again on the show.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll just say MBR.
MBR. It doesn't have any meaning.
It doesn't have any meaning. What it is, it's so packed with stuff.
It's huge.
It's not as big as a regular budget, but it's packed with a lot. So I think essentially we're doing a budget every year now in Ohio.
That's what I was getting at. And that's a lot of work. I mean, if you're a journalist and you're talking tucked away here and tucked away there, have you been able to really get a good sense about what's in the legislation altogether?
Well, it takes a team. Me. I would say no.
Well, I mean, it's in the governor's off-year budget proposals all got split into about a dozen bills.
Right.
So it's not even like it's one big boat that you can watch. It's a whole bunch of big boats. And who knows at what point something gets put on there that you maybe didn't see at first, and then, oh, look over here, there's another bill going through. So it makes it really difficult to follow. And you've heard lawmakers complain about it last time 2 years ago, and they're complaining about it again now, even hearing some dissent from House Republicans who said this is not the way to do things.
Let me give you an example. The governor's off your budget came through, and they split it up into like education, human services, etc. The human services bill was less than one page based on the governor's introduction. It was created the office of, I don't know, some office of job something within
which I thought we already had. But
yeah,
on.
Within the Department of Job and Family Services. Okay. Now that bill is like 38 pages after it left the House. So that's what happened to it, you know, the House. So the governor introduces a lot of policy, a lot of stuff. The House then puts a lot more stuff into it, and now the Senate will take its turn at it. And, the you know, who those pages will be added. Mm-hmm. A lot of pages will be added.
And by the way, these are all Republicans. They're all from the same party.
The majority, mm-hmm. Yeah. The majority of Republicans in both.
Certainly Republican-controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, the thing that I hear a lot, especially from advocates for different issues, you know, different things, mental health or education or whatever it is, there's a generally becoming weariness about, you know, the governor or, you know, the budgets basically being put in with 5, 6, 7 year phase ins or phase outs or that sort of thing. Because as we've seen, you know, just let's take tax reform. As we look at tax reform, a lot of the things that were initially put in 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and things that were intended, you know, to happen as far as tax reform actually haven't happened because we've had budgets that have come in since and they have changed things. They've changed the dynamics of it. So when you're, you know, if you're an advocate for a education group and you want a certain policy or something put in place, you're really nervous when they start saying, well, now in 5 years we're going to do this, in 7 years we're going to do this, because you don't know, because we have a budget every year. You don't know in 5, 7, 9 years if that's actually going to stay there or is that going to be changed and you're going to lose again. So I hear that, you know, from different advocates when they're talking about, you know, the budget and plans. They want their money now. They want to take their money now and run because they see this yeah. whole trend of budgeting changing so much.
Does it put a lot more power in the governor's office when he operates this way?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
He sets the tone.
Yeah,
he's definitely setting the agenda for the legislature.
Well, these bills originated from his office. They were presented by legislators on behalf of the governor. And then after that, I really like Representative Terry Boos's analogy that these are Christmas tree bills.
Right.
And that they just, you know, lawmakers, as they go through, just tack on all sorts of different earmarks.
Because we all love lots of ornaments on our trees.
Oh, yes, lots of ornaments. You want the most fabulous tree that you can possibly have by the end. And everybody wants their ornament on the tree. And, you know, I see it from both sides. I see where they are complaining that the governor is maybe exerting too much of his own policy into the state house. The lawmakers are the ones that should be writing the laws. But then on the other hand, You kind of want like this idea of all your government officials kind of working together. And this is a way where I can see if I were a lawmaker, it's like, well, this is a way for me to get what's best for my constituents. And this bill is going to pass because it came from the governor. So let's try and, you know, make it the most ours that we possibly can before we put our stamp on it.
I think it also speaks to kind of Kasich's personality, which is get it done. You know, he's not a real patient man. I mean, he wants to get things done. He doesn't enjoy the lengthy debates. You know, he's got ideas. I mean, you look, he came into office, he created Jobs Ohio, and, you know, he boom, boom, boom. He wants to get things done. So I think it kind of, the off-year budget kind of reflects his style of governing, of, you know, getting things done quicker. And I think there's some constituencies that like that because, you know, you wait around forever for things to happen. So there's mm-hmm. there's some that like that. But I think that's what it kind of reflects him.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Let's turn back to voting for just a moment. Civil rights groups are suing the state over changes to early voting. Joe Ingles, what's the argument?
Well, you know, we see these changes to early voting. Like, for example, this year, we had the Secretary of State say there wasn't going to be voting on the Sunday before the election in November. Well, that really angered the Democrats because we see in some urban areas there's a very popular Democratic initiative called Souls to the Polls, where they take people in minority churches, in minority neighborhoods, and they put them on buses and they head down to the polls and vote on Sunday. You know, they say that that's getting capturing a population of people who might otherwise not get to vote because of transportation or other issues. And so the Democrats are very upset about taking away the Sunday voting. There's also a general consensus among Democrats that they're trying, that the Republican legislature is trying to take away accessibility in general for low-income people, for people who who might otherwise find it difficult. You know, if you can only vote from 9 to 5, or you can only vote by mail, there are a lot of people who feel like they would not be able to vote because either they, you know, can't vote by mail, or they might not even be, you know, literate enough to sometimes go. That's not an easy process to vote by mail if you really have problems with English or things like that. So a lot of people just like to go to the polls. They want to vote at the polls, and they want the polls to be open when they're not working. And that's what it boils down to. They say that the Democrats who have filed this lawsuit say that they want this so that people of minorities, women, poor, can go to the polls and vote, and that they've had this opportunity and you're taking it away.
So what court's it in? Well, how is it going to proceed?
It's in the federal court, and I don't know, you know— That's a loaded question. How's it going to proceed? We've seen in the past that federal courts have generally been very sympathetic to these issues. Mm-hmm. If you look back in 2012, when some of these issues were brought up by the it was actually President Obama's campaign that spearheaded that effort. And when they went to a federal court, the federal court said, hey, basically, you've got to put all this stuff back in there. It was upheld. They put it all back in there. But there's been in the past couple of years, there's been a movement to try to once again take away some of those days and tighten up election law to go to where we were, you know, 10 years ago. Now, this being said, Ohio has one of the most liberal opportunities to vote of anywhere in the nation. If you look at the weekend voting, the fact that we have 3 weeks before an election that you can vote, we have early voting opportunities. There are a lot of opportunities we have in Ohio that they don't have in other states. Mm-hmm. And that's what people will point out. I think there was a movement initially to make it a big tent, bring everyone in, make it as convenient for everyone. And now that they're trying to pull back on that, that's where they're getting some feedback.
And that's I think that's the issue, though, that these groups that are seeking, you have the ACLU of Ohio, the NAACP of Ohio, League of Women Voters of Ohio, several churches are the ones that filed the lawsuit. And then Joe alluded to the 2012 case with the Obama campaign. That case is actually still open. And the Democratic Party of Ohio has petitioned that judge to make his ruling permanent and restore those last 3 days, the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before Election Day for early voting. But what those groups are saying, they're not the core of their argument isn't that, you know, Ohio has enough opportunities to vote. It's that the reduction in voting is going to discriminate against other people. So usually that's the argument that the other side brings up is, well, you know, Ohio has tons of opportunities to vote, but that's not really the issue that's being argued here. It's whether the reduction in voting leads to less people being able to vote in Ohio.
In certain groups.
Right.
Right. We were talking earlier about the off-year budget bill and how some lawmakers are complaining that they can't get anything else done. But we were all relieved last week, of course, to learn that the state now has an official rock song. They did
very
squeeze
important
this into their schedule.
Legislation.
Jackie Borchardt, why are lawmakers spending time on an official rock song?
Well, you know, and if you talk to a lot of people, they say it is a waste of time because Hang On Sloopy, which is the song that they've chosen, that the House passed, is already the official state rock song because of a 1985 resolution in the House that said this is the official state rock song. But the issue is it's not in state law. And lawmakers, I know, how did that happen?
You've lost sleep over that too, haven't you, Ann?
Yes, that and thunderstorms, yes.
So last year when they passed the Adena Pipe bill, making that the state artifact of Ohio, and they were looking, had to go back and read state law for this piece of legislation, noticed that, oh wow, Hang On Sloopy is not in state law. We need to rectify this wrong. And, you know, we laugh about it, but
I'm not laughing.
It's sad. It really is.
It is, but I don't know. As someone who sits in a lot of hard chairs, you know, throughout the week listening to a lot of, you know, drabble. And it's kind of nice to have a break in that schedule, to have someone come in and sing a song and have, you know, lawmakers actually look alive and not sleeping, you know.
Laughing with each other.
It's a bipartisan bill.
Gosh,
it had wide bipartisan support. And to be fair, it only took 3 minutes for them to pass it on the floor, including all the debate. and the vote counting.
Team building.
All right. Team
Can
building
I point out two things here, though?
Hang
On Sleepy to Me is not a rock song, number one. Number two, I thought it was very curious that when the Ohio State Buckeyes band came in last week on the floor, that we had all this media coverage and everything else. At 1:30 in the morning, however, when they decided to actually debate the energy standards and do something with that, it was
crickets. No cameras.
Crickets.
That was
crickets.
The music.
It was
okay,
crickets.
Okay, I'll get some cricket sound for the next show. Joe Ingles, thank you from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jackie Borchardt for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks again for joining us today. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.